Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the History of Fresh Produce, the podcast series that explores the fascinating and often overlooked history of fresh fruits and vegetables. Here are your hosts, Patrick Kelly and John Parr.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the History of Fresh Produce. Hello, Patrick. Today we're talking about blueberries. Going back to our roots here and talking crops.
We were just talking about that the other day on the phone. We were like, we started off talking about crops and then we got into all the crazy history of fresh produce stories. And we're like, no, we're going to go back to crops. So we're back to crops, everyone.
Yeah. We got to throw some of those in there because they're still interesting stories. They're just more expansive rather than a specific moment in time. So,
100%.
And blueberries definitely has its story to tell. Definitely. I mean, blueberries, I'm not a big blueberry guy. I don't know. Are you a big blueberry guy?
So, yes, I pretty much have blueberries with my yogurt every day. My daughter will devour a pint of blueberries. And I will tell you, I say sometimes it's hit and miss, but I like sweet blueberries, not like acidy or like tart blueberries. And everybody has a different type, right? So I'm always going for like the sweetest blueberry.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Just saying.
Fair enough. Well, the blueberry is definitely an interesting one. So blueberries, I think it's important to understand that they start off just like every crop, wild. And these wild blueberries are, first of all, native to North America. And we're going to talk, not that there were other berries somewhere else, you know, Europe had something called the bilberry, which is basically their equivalent of blueberries, but we're going to be talking about the blueberry that we know today, which is based and originated in North America. So what created the environment for this crop? So about 25,000 years ago, there was this mile thick layer of ice just covering the entire area of what is now Maine. And this ice covering begins to retreat and melt. And as these glaciers are scraping against the land, these huge rock boulders were ground into smaller stones, gravel, and sand. And this slowly creates a condition where the wild blueberry plant is able to survive in these very unique soil. It's a very thin, acidic glacial soil. And these plants, these wild blueberry plants, begin to spread all throughout the barrens of this region, again, mostly around Maine and that part of Canada as well. So this was pretty much the first fruit to find its home in this environment once the glacial structures begin to melt. So who are the first people to find these things and to work with them? So you have the Wabanaki native people who are the first to have said to work with wild blueberries, the first to have grown them on a large scale. They would use a burn, prune, and harvest technique for these wild blueberries. And they would dry the blueberries, often as an ingredient in pemmican, which is basically the original food bar. I think we've talked about pemmican in a few other episodes. Different cultures kind of have different names for it, but basically incorporated pulverized dry fish or meats. They would melt and they would form into cakes baked by the sun. And this would provide energy and would last for months and was easily portable on long journeys. So very important food stuff for the Wabanaki people. And as Native Americans also gathered blueberries and boiled them for a few hours before simply being shaped them into these cakes, the roots of the blueberry plant were also boiled. And this was used for making tea. So again, we've seen this before with a few other crops that we've talked about with Native American, Indigenous American peoples, that all parts of the plant were used. Very rarely were just the fruit themselves used. Now, much earlier, Indigenous peoples used these controlled burns to increase the yields of blueberries. And it's a technique that's even still used today in some of these areas. in Maine. And every few years, these fields may be burned to eliminate the old shrubs and then fertilize the soil. And the Native American tribes, including the Mi'kmaq, and this is a tough one. So I apologize to any listeners associated with this tribe. I'm going to do my best. It's called the Passamaquoddy tribes. Have been working with government and private agency and still maintain the blueberry barrens of this region today. So they do still play a role with this cultural product that they've been associated with in their culture. And blueberries keep really long time in storage, more than many other type of berries, make them really an important crop for these tribes in their history. And so, in addition to it being a foodstuff and a very resilient food for storage, the Maliseet natives valued them also because they believed it to bring stamina. Okay, and why did they believe it brought stamina? Because they were also a food that bears like to eat. So they associated, well, bears like to eat it, and bears have a lot of stamina, they're strong, that would bring them the same thing. Other groups believe that the wild blueberry with their star-shaped crown was then sent by the creator to feed the children in times of food scarcity. So there's a lot of mythical, religious aspects to the value of the blueberry as well. So again, pretty consistent with some of the other crops that we've talked about that have originated in the Americas in terms of the use of the crop and as a foodstuff, all parts of the plant, as well as within their culture and their religion. But like every story we seem to have shared starting in the Americas, we have the Europeans that inevitably enter the scene.
It always ends up in Europe. It always does.
They enter the scene.
I'm just saying, you know, it always happens that well. I mean, we talk about the Europeans as well. I mean, Samuel de Champlain in 1615, during one of his many explorations, now everyone, this gives the earliest known account to Native Americans, the Algonquins. Okay, all right. So eating blueberries. I remember that. I remember that as a Native American. And not me, just learning about it. The berries were wonderfully abundant, and the indigenous population dried them for winter use, which is obviously knowing how to do that back in the 1600s is amazing to show how we were able to store and prep our food. The Jesuit missionary Paule Jun recorded in Relation de ce qui s'est passé en la Nouvelle Française sur le Grand Fleuve de Saint-Laurent. Which is the relation. You like that? I did all right. I think I would have got like the out of that. The relation of what was occurred in New France on the great river St. Lawrence in the year 1634. What the savages consumed, focusing on beliefs and customs. Lejeune noted that some of them imagine a paradise abounding in blueberries. Ooh. So the first European settlers enjoyed these berries because they were similar to types of berries that grew in their homeland. Everyone, the Scots associated them with the blaberry, the Irish with whortleberries, the Danes with bittleberries, the Swedes with blabar, and the Germans with brickberrin and blaberrin. The native North Americans taught them how to prepare them in various dishes in the New World. So as you can tell, John, a lot of them had something to the nature of a blueberry already in their world. Might have been some of a different variety, but some type of blueberry was being grown. The blueberries became a popular ingredient in pies, jams, and other baked goods, and were also used to make types of wine. So these early colonists also boiled blueberries into milk and made gray paint. That makes sense. You know, I always like when you pop a blueberry, you can get sometimes when they're really juicy, you'll get like the purplish blue out of it, and it will stain everybody. Okay. It will stain. But you can use that as food coloring too if you need to. So early colonists also boiled blueberries in milk to make that gray paint. Think about what they were thinking during that time. I want you seriously, because what would they have to do to mix those two things together? What made them think about that? Or were they putting that together to try food? Like, that's what I want you to think about. Like, were they making a little, like, did the milk go sour? And all of a sudden they mixed some blueberries in there to get it sweeter. It turned gray. Maybe left it, or one of the kids spilt it. And then they realize we're not getting that gray off the off the table. And you know, turned into something else. And then the famous traditional blue paint used in the homes of Shakers was made from blueberry skins, sage blossoms, and indigo and milk.
Well, there
you go. So a lot of things, John.
Yeah, you can use blueberries for a lot, apparently.
You can, 100%.
So, but I mean, it's another good example. I mean, and who knows? Maybe the Europeans had these experiences with their berries back home and decided to try to adopt them as well with these new world blueberries. But what happens thereafter? So obviously we all know the United States comes to formation, and then we have the Civil War. And the Civil War is really a turning point for the blueberries. And we saw this, where do we see this? There's another crop with the Civil War. It's not coming to me right now, but maybe it will later. But the Civil War happens to play another major role in the push and the expansion of the blueberry. So what happens? So the wild blueberry from Maine had been underappreciated for centuries while the Europeans were in the Americas prior to the Civil War. It was a local, regional good that people enjoyed. And pretty much outside that, you really didn't know it and have access to it. And you even have Henry David Thoreau, which I'm sure our listeners might recognize that name as a famous author. He wrote in his lost manuscript, Wild Fruits, which was actually published more than a century after his death in 1862, that he said, "We do not realize how rich our country is in berries." And this was notable because New England people ate wild blueberries and sold them commercially. Okay, they were quite, again, available in the region where they were, but few knew them outside the region. So then the Civil War came. And now, prior to the Civil War, seafood canneries were the big business in Maine, and their big customers were southern markets. Now, you can connect the dots. Civil War breaks out. Maine ain't sending any more seafood cans down to south, as they are enemies. So how do these businesses adapt to a drastic change in the environment that they're in? So they turn to what's in their backyards. They see blueberries and they have cans. So they say, all right, we're going to start canning blueberries. And this worked out very well because during the Civil War, the Union Army was desperate for food for their soldiers, particularly food that could prevent scurvy. Because again, we all know that scurvy was a big concern still at this period in time, and blueberries fit that bill. So you have production of wild blueberries going into cans really kicking up during the Civil War. They're shipping them by sea to the Union Army. And obviously, you couldn't match the convenience and the ease of storage and the health benefits of this food. It was just a very opportunistic, fortunate events that blueberries was able to take advantage of during the Civil War. And so these soldiers who consume these berries regularly throughout the event develop a taste for these sweet wild blueberries and take it home with them after the war. And obviously, if you have something that you really love and enjoy, you're going to want more of it. So with all the soldiers returning back home, they start saying, we want more blueberries. And that in turn kicks up the production of wild blueberries. But that is not, we're still not at the point of cultivation though, because remember, nope, these are wild blueberries. These are just wild bushes growing in the barrens of Maine, people going in, picking them, canning them, yep, sending them out. So this is not, you know, it's not an environment where you have farmers setting up blueberry farms and controlling the yields and the growing seasons and things like this. That's going to come, but still going to be several decades away from now. Perhaps this is a good time to take a break. When we get back, we're going to talk about the Blueberry War that precedes the cultivation of the blueberries. And then we're going to get into how these blueberries came to be what we recognize them as today. So
get ready for the blueberry wars. Here they come.
There's always a war, isn't there? There's always a fruit war. Anyway, we'll be right back.
JGLC, the place to be, a third-generation, family-owned and operated asset-based company. Throughout their 60 years in business, integrity, reliability, and loyalty to their customers has remained their top priority. JGLC guarantees 24/7 communication with your personal logistics coordinator. They offer competitive pricing without sacrificing services. They operate throughout the United States and Canada. JGLC's customers count on them for dependability and dedication carried out on every order, every time. 60 years of service for all your trucking needs. Visit them at jglc.com for your custom quote.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the History of Fresh Produce. We are talking about blueberries, and we just finished off the Civil War. People hungry for blueberries after having had to have eaten them throughout the war. Well, specifically the Union, the Confederates didn't get their hands on blueberries, unfortunately.
Oh man, well let's get into the blueberry war. I mean, Bernard in Minnesota once the dense pine forest that served the indigenous of the Chippewa as hunting grounds and blueberry fields. This blueberry war is going to get kicked off. And in 1872, a pair of White Earth Nation brothers linked to disappearance of Ellen MacArthur, a 22-year-old woman from Old Crow Wing Village. Now, the Native Americans are lynched from a Norway pine in front of the Last Turn Saloon in 1872 without a trail. So you can tell, as always, there's leading up to it. If you remember going back to Hawaii, I remember they executed one of the brothers or the sons of one of the kings of the ships, remember? And it all starts over, like I said, of one of the heirs or somebody or something happens. So fears of retaliation by the Ojibwe tribes encamped nearby prompts sheriff to telegraph the governor of Minnesota to request troops to defend the remote town from imminent reprisals. So now they're getting worried, right? Over food. It's food again, everyone. Food again. The Telegraph reports that the Native Americans, sullen and threatening, were gathering in large numbers. Around the same time of MacArthur's mysterious disappearance, a family of settlers were allegedly murdered by Native Americans in the general vicinity that spring, you know what I mean, of the same trail. So only 10 years since the U.S.-Dakota War, a violent war as there was in Minnesota, which occurred in the Civil War. And people were expecting something similar in Bernard. People got into trains and went to Duluth because they anticipated there was going to be violence. A St. Paul newspaper dubs the deployment of troops to Bernard as the farcical Blueberry War, probing the governor for being an alarmist. So like national titles were hitting the newspapers. Minnesota's National Guard is deployed from St. Paul by the governor and arrives at Bernard Headquarters Hotel, 75 soldiers in all. So leaders of the Ojibwe are camped on the west bank of the Mississippi River. Troops met with the chief and the Native Americans, and they learned the true intent was to come to just sell and trade their harvest of fresh blueberries, not to start war. It was a blueberry harvest season and very common at the time that the Native Americans would come to town to trade blueberries. After the encounter, 50 of the soldiers were sent back to St. Paul the day after they arrived.
And that was it.
For no reason at all. The Blueberry War really the start of a farmer's market.
Yep, pretty much.
Oh my gosh.
That's what hysteria does, you know? That's
what does. And this thing moves into, obviously, the 20th century. So everyone, as we move into the 20th century, wasn't until probably the early in the 20th century that blueberries became a truly viable crop, John, and a real commodity. That was when government scientist Frederick Colville of the U.S. Department of Ag working with Elizabeth C. White of Whitesbog, New Jersey, began developing varieties of blueberries that could be grown on farms and in home gardens. And that's what's important. Coville discovered that blueberries require acidic soil. In his many trials, he noticed that much of our food, instead, blueberries plants thrive in peat bogs and acidic soils across all the country. Coville replicated this poor soil in his lab and eventually succeeded in pinpointing the requirements that blueberries actually need to succeed in growth. So Coville, the father of the blueberry, I thought the father of the blueberry was like Gary Wisniewski or his dad, but no, now, you know, Wish Farms, but now I get it. The father of blueberry perfected methods of propagating that are still in use today, 100 years later. Elizabeth White was born in 1871 into a South Jersey cranberry growing Quaker family and oldest of the four daughters of a cranberry grower whose land lay in the Pine Barrens, million acre stretch of land southeastern New Jersey. Now, everyone, Elizabeth was bright. We got to talk about that. So interested in ag and native plants and physically impressed and impressive, right? You would be impressed because she is an impressive 6 feet tall, just as tall as John as I. That's not bad, John. So over 6 feet tall and given to wearing Whistler's motherish long black dresses, you would be able to spot her walking down the street. Might think she's a widow at some point as well. But she began working with her family and farm when she was 22. And John, I'll let you take over about her working for her family.
Yeah. No, she does definitely seem like an impressive character. So White and her father, so I think it's important to understand what their farm looked like and the relevance of their farm. So their farm was one of the largest farms in the country. Cranberry farms, I should say, not general farms, cranberry farms in the country. And when they were working on the farm, they often noticed wild blueberries near their cranberry bogs. And they would often go back and forth to each other, meaning, oh, you know, it'd be really great and helpful if we had a domestic variety of blueberries. I mean, they're growing here naturally. There must be a good conditions for them to grow. Not only that, but they believed that having blueberries as part of their portfolio would help extend the growing season. Again, similar things that we see with growers today. Anything you can do to extend the growing season in your business. And this, of course, would then lead to giving extra employment to their pickers. And their pickers, again, similar today, some things don't change, were mostly seasonal workers. They had about 600 pickers during peak season, and many of them were Italian immigrants who actually lived in satellite villages where their farm was located. And those villages, unsurprisingly, are called Florence and Rome. Again, most of the immigrants were from Italy. So in 1910, Elizabeth comes across an article by Dr. Coville, and it's called Experiments in Blueberry Culture. Now, Elizabeth, as Patrick, you mentioned, was a bright woman, very interested in ag and plants. So she got extremely excited at seeing this and shared it with her father. And they agreed that they should invite Coville to partner an experiment with them at their farm. So White offers Coville this ideal, basically petri dish, ideal land to cultivate these wild plants into a cultivated blueberry variety. She also provides a link, of course, and this is very important too, to the local people of the region. So these people, locals, know obviously the terrain better than anybody else versus a botanist working in DC. So with her connections and her relationships within the locality, she's able to offer incentive to her neighbors and townspeople through two different ways. She's offering money. Money always talks. But also, and I think probably even more potentially attractive, is the opportunity for immortality. And no, she's not giving you some sort of potion that's going to make you live forever, but you will get to have a worthy bush, if one is found, to be named after you. So, Patrick, if you were able to find that lucky wild blueberry bush, maybe it would be called the Patrick Kelly berry or so. Which
it'll be called the Platberry.
The Platberry. Oh, yeah, that's not bad. I like that. Yeah. All right. Anyway, was not Patrick Kelly that found the blueberry, but in 1911, Coville journeys from D.C. to visit White in Whitesbog. And this begins this collaborative work that eventually gives us domesticated blueberry. So what happens? So they get about somewhere around 100 wildlings provided to them, and they start transplanting and such. And only a few of the 100 are worthy of propagating. And the best one ends up being found by a name named Rube Leake. Now, this was not something White and Coville were hoping for in terms of a name. This ended up actually being a pretty struggling issue because, again, remember White said whoever found the promising bush, they would name the thing after. Now, Rube, White thought, seemed a poor name for an aristocratic bush, in her words. And then Leake was obviously out of the question because its association with onion. So finally, Coville puts his mind to this and comes up with a solution. He says, all right, how about we add the last initial to Rube, so L from Leake, and then make the variety called Rubel. You know, sounds like a gem. It's got a nice ring to it, and that's what they go with, Rubel. And while the berries ended up being quite small by modern day standards, it's still a variety that's grown today, especially after scientists discovered these high concentrations of antioxidants in this variety. So that was the birth of the Rubel blueberry. Now in 1914, they picked their first berries from a successful cross-pollination, and by 1916, the first blueberry crop was for sale. So now, 1916, we have the official cultivated crop of blueberries. And Coville, of course, is just showered in praises. You know, this is a huge achievement. It's printed in the June 1916 edition of National Geographic, and it was an article titled "The Wild Blueberry Tamed: The New Industry of the Pine Barrens of New Jersey." So, pretty riveting, exciting title. And he noted that because blueberries grow best in soils, so acid has to be considered worthless for other agricultural purposes. So, blueberry was also seen as this great crop that could grow in soils that was not really used by any other crop. So it just made an opportunity out of something that hadn't been usable before in terms of land space. So Coville eventually develops close to 100,000 bushes, so many varieties that there's an expert named James Hancock that said that, quote, "a testimony to the greatness of his efforts is in the fact that 75% of the blueberry acreage in the 1990s was composed of his hybrids." So seven of the top 10 cultivars are actually Coville progenies. So Coville definitely earned his title as father of the blueberry, and New Jersey, without much surprise, eventually adopted the cultivated blueberry as the state's fruit and began to plant it along highways. I'll have to keep my eyes open the next time I'm on a Jersey highway. That's only the next state over. But that's how we got to the cultivated blueberry. But I think it's important not to lose sight of the wild blueberry. And the wild blueberry is important because it's not that the wild blueberry didn't taste good or was not enjoyed as much as a cultivated blueberry. Wild blueberries, in actually many cases, people argue, taste better, have a better eating experience. But the problem was the shelf life and the handling of wild blueberries is not something that you can really transport over long distances. It has to be consumed within just a couple of days or whatnot, which is why, again, they would can them and freeze them and sell them that way. Now, talking about wild blueberries, going back to our Wabanaki tribe people. So despite the horrific ordeal that the native peoples had to go through since European introduction onto this continent, they remained connected to that landscape and to the blueberry. And so by the 1960s, most of the harvest labor in these blueberry fields were actually from the Wabanaki tribes. And before the use of mechanical harvesting, a lot of these Wabanaki tribe members would flock to the Barrens for month-long intensive raking rendezvous, often living in small camps provided by the farm owners. And you just see this landscape stretched with rakers going through these wild blueberry fields and pulling their rakes and little dustpans and just sifting through these, you know, the sea of blues. And given their knowledge of the landscape, which again has been passed down for centuries and centuries and centuries, and then of course the plants and the harvest, the Passamaquoddy tribe actually decided to purchase the Northeastern Blueberry Company with a share of their settlement from the Indian Land Claims Settlement Act of 1980. So they ended up purchasing about 2,000 acres of barrens in Columbia Falls, Columbia, Centerville, and Township 19 in Maine. And the tribe decided that 100% of the company's profits were going to be reinvested into the future growth or distributed to the Passamaquoddy tribe. And so in 2013, this company then rebranded from Northeastern Blueberry Company to PWBC. And since its inception, the business has managed to stay true to its mission and has provided economic opportunity for their tribe and honor their cultural connection with the wild blueberry while also making, you know, the necessary pivots to stay economically viable in what's a very volatile market, especially when you're dealing with wild, because again, you can't control many of the things that are happening when something is growing. So this company, again, managed by this indigenous tribe, continues to use hand raking, where a lot of people are obviously using mechanical systems today. And this stands obviously to in deep contrast because of that. That's not to say they don't use any mechanization in their process. They do have a degree of that as well, of course, to hedge themselves, because you're not going to do everything with hand rakers and with Mother Nature dictating what's going to happen at harvest time. But they are trying to stay as connected as they can to their cultural origins with this crop. And so today, wild blueberries are actually grown on 44,000 acres in Maine. And 99% of the crop is frozen, right? Because I explained how that can't really be transported. And most of that food is then used as a food ingredient. So actually less than 1% of the wild blueberry crop is sold fresh today. So it's kind of an amazing story about blueberries. I mean, I'm interested now to try a wild blueberry. They're smaller.
Be careful,
they're
though.
Much smaller.
Yeah, be careful, because you've all seen Into the Wild. Just be careful.
Yes, yes. You want
we
to
We should
careful.
Do it. Listen, there could be a History of Fresh Produce on movies. I'm telling you.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Well, we'll probably do that at some point. But so anyway, so if you ever get like frozen berries or, I don't know, jams, blueberry jams, most likely they're wild blueberries. Most likely they're wild blueberries. And they're much smaller. If you see pictures.
They're a lot smaller. They're not like those jumbo ones or the ones that are, you know, like where you see people and they're just like, whoa.
Yeah, like, they're huge. And they're not as dark. You know, the wild blueberries are much darker.
No. Definitely not.
Much darker. So it's so that's the story of the blueberry. It doesn't have necessarily as a exciting history as some of our other crops.
It's okay.
But it's still... again, has an interesting connection between its influence on historical events and how it got there, you know, with Civil War, of course, and then the indigenous peoples, and then the desire to create more opportunities for farmers on soil that wasn't being
True.
Used for anything else.
Listen, I think with people like us that are just, you know, loving the history of fresh produce and everything that encompasses fresh produce, you know, a bee doesn't explain to a fly why honey's better, you know? So at the end of the day, each one of these crops has some type of significant history to the agricultural and farming world.
I can't say much more than that.
Nope. History of Fresh Produce Club, everyone.
Yes, keep the eyes open.
On the rise.
It is coming. And In addition to that, we will have also more episodes coming soon. I'm trying to remember what we have coming soon. I can't think of it. I do
just
definitely
stay tuned.
Stay tuned. This summer, though, was it? I don't know. We're less than 3 months?
Who knows?
Away? 2 months, 2.5 months away from the Olympics. So definitely stay tuned for that. We have a lot of fun content coming for the Summer Olympics.
Yes, we do.
So on that hook and incentive, until next time, it's goodbye from me, John Papp.
And goodbye from me, Patrick Kelly.